Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special where we get someone in to pick the tunes. I played Count Ozzy just to begin there with Leslie Butler from an album called Roots of Rastafari. It comes from an album called Soul Jazz called Roots of Rastafari, and it's simply called Soul Drums. There's going to be a lot of talk of drums and drumming tonight on the program because my guest is the percussionist Colin Curry. Colin, you're very welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Great to have you here. And I've known your name for a while, Colin. I've known your music for a while because of your work with Steve Reich, and we'll talk about that as time goes on. But Colin, where are you from originally? Your CV goes as far as Scotland. It's no more specific than that.
Well, I was born in Edinburgh, born and raised in Edinburgh, and my musical training took me to Glasgow every week in my teenage years. So between the ages of 13 and 17, I was in Glasgow every weekend. So that was a very important place for me growing up. And then I moved to London to study Royal Academy of Music in 1994 to 98. And London's been my home ever since. So that's it, broadly speaking.
What sort of a place is Edinburgh? I mean, that's a big question, but yeah. I'm going along the kind of the sort of cliched suggestion that it's not really Scotland, you know, it's some separate kind of a place.
Well, there is a bit of that aspect to it. I mean, I think one of the great things about Edinburgh is that it's so close to Glasgow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I can say that as an Edinburgher. I love the city. I mean, I've just been there this weekend. I mean, it's totally stunning. And I was walking in the hills in the southwest of the city. Beautiful day yesterday, glorious views over the city, and of course out to sea, which is the thing that can be overlooked about Edinburgh, is that it's essentially on the sea.
Right.
So you kind of, one can be forgiven for forgetting that there's this sort of maritime aspect to it. So you're right by...
Do you know what? That's never occurred to
me.
Well,
there you go. Yeah. Gotcha.
But it's not a port city though, is it?
Well, there's Leith Docks.
All right. Okay.
But not in the same sense that Glasgow would be seen as such.
Yeah, with of course, the Clyde and all that.
The Clyde and the shipbuilding industry, that was not so much part of Edinburgh, certainly no comparison. Very different cities. Edinburgh is a gorgeous city, it's a beautiful city, and it's home of the festival, which is a colossal thing. And I love it, but I'm very fond of Glasgow as a city as well, I would have to say.
It's a lively place, isn't
it?
Yeah. It's got a good feel about it.
Yeah, wonderful people, very friendly, very laconic, very sarky, but very friendly.
And your musical education, well, at school, first of all, what were you good at school that led you down this road?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I growing up, my main interest started probably in jazz, big band, and pop music. I mean, that's what drove me. And I was an avid reader of Smash Hits magazine and things like that when I was growing up. And I was into mainstream pop, certain types of mainstream pop, and very definitely big bands. I used to play in a lot of big bands growing up.
Now, at that time, it seems not very common, I would imagine, to be involved in big bands. I mean, that music as a popular form was kind of long gone by then.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's been on the way out for a while in many ways, or having to find a new platform. But I think growing up in Edinburgh, one of the things that was lucky was the huge amount of local music available, not just the youth orchestras from local authorities, but amateur bands and school bands. I mean, I would be outsourced as someone who was perceived as having some kind of talent. I would be brought in to plug the gaps in different school bands in my area. Also brass bands, the competitive brass bands. Occasionally I would be dragooned into playing with different brass bands.
And was there any conflict in your head between the pop music you were enjoying and reading about in Smash Hits and the big band and the school band, which can be a little rigid and not really swing all that much, you know?
I would say there wasn't really a conflict there, but certainly the conflict was closed when I discovered classical music, because for me, that swept the board with a lot of it.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How early?
Probably 12 or 13. Once I discovered certain key pieces by Stravinsky, Bartok, and certain modernists, this just totally... I mean, that just changed everything, and I more or less hung up my pop aspirations, and although they were to return, in fact, and I end up playing lots of pieces and styles of music more closer to that in more recent years, which is kind of interesting, perhaps.
Okay, well, look, let's have your first musical choice, and we'll come back to some of that. Mm. Do you want to start with Oscar Peterson?
Yeah, sure. Well, the thing about this track is that there was a lot of Oscar Peterson played at home. My parents heard him live in concert, and they had some LPs of his. And on this particular track, you can hear Buddy Rich playing. And I was actually lucky enough to hear Buddy Rich perform on what turned out to be his last ever European tour. He was one of the most bewildering jazz musicians of all time. A controversial figure, not always easy to love.
Not a nice man.
No, not a nice man. Probably you could put that in stone. I mean, he was not a kind soul. But, and he's not to everyone's tastes. There's a lot of dissent among drummers about his playing. But I totally disagree. Because you can hear, especially on this track, where he's actually playing the brushes, the finesse and the artistry is just phenomenal.
And before you play this one, Colin, it's Oscar Peterson plays Basie. Is this Peterson with a big band or with a small setup?
It's a smaller combo. Yeah. There's bass, there's guitar. Herb Ellis on guitar. Mm. So it's just a small group, and it's just so totally charming. I mean, it just scampers along with the feel of it, the sound of it, the way they interact. It's just timeless, classic jazz.
This is Topsy, Oscar Peterson. And that's Topsy from Oscar Peterson. Oscar Peterson plays Count Basie as the album. My guest tonight, Colin Curry, is a percussionist of some renown, and Colin chose that as his first track because Buddy Rich was there. Now, I want to get some sense, Colin, of how you trained, if that's the word, or educated as a drummer, because for most kids like me, the ambition, if you were to be a drummer, would be to get into a rock band and start thrashing. This is before I would have heard jazz or anything else, you know.
Yeah.
But the idea of being taught drums, learning to read for drumming, and then, of course, that there's more to it. It's percussion. It's all sorts of instruments. So tell me a little bit about that route. Was your first instrument a drum kit, as we know it?
Yes. My first instrument would be the snare drum. Mm-hmm. Because I was very young when I started. I wanted to start even younger, but I was deemed too small to play the drums, physically hold the sticks. But eventually, age six, there was a capitulation. And in fact, I was recalling my first drum lesson the other day, this was a moment of great excitement. I do remember being at the school, and just couldn't stop jumping up and down. I was so excited. But made it in for my first lesson, which was on the snare drum. And I remember my teacher demonstrating the snare drum roll before my very eyes. And I just remember my mind was blown by this, be it the proximity to this amazing sound and this sort of, physical act, which seemed so magical, this throwing together of all these incredibly fast notes to create the snare drum roll right in front of my very eyes and ears. But in that room, there were other instruments. There was a drum kit, there were timpani, there were tuned instruments, there was a xylophone. And I was intrigued by all of this. And I just thought there was so much to the family of instruments. And of course, I had no idea quite where this would all lead and what I would be able to do with it. But I think I had this amazing, I was just purely drawn to drums and percussion from that very early age, starting out on the drums, but leading elsewhere later.
And what drummers... I mean, at that age, it's hard to know what you might have been exposed to. I mean, you did hear Buddy Rich and people like that, thanks to your parents, I guess, and whoever else was on those records. On television, of course, Buddy Rich would have been a guest on TV shows in those days as well, and people like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he was one of those figures who would do the chat show route, and he was also a very funny man. He was a comedian. He was an actor. He was a humorist. A singer. He did all kinds of things. So you would see him popping up in all kinds of places. Famously, he was on The Muppet Show. He did a drum battle with Animal and all this kind of thing.
Regular on Parkinson, but maybe that's before your time.
I've seen the clips now, I've had that delve, had that rabbit hole moment on the internet with him. But I was increasingly aware of all the many, many different kinds of percussion music around. And for me, quite quickly, it was not simply about... just having what you mentioned earlier in the conversation, the thrash, the thrill of the thrash. I mean, that's still there for me, but I started to feel that maybe there was quite a lot else to it as well.
Mm. And pretty soon, I guess, the lessons you were getting at school wouldn't have been enough.
Quite. Yeah. So, I mean, there was also the classical element trickling into what I was doing, and that eventually took over entirely, and the sort of pop aspirations ceased. For me, and I wanted to train further on these instruments, so I had to do an audition. We decided as a family that I would do an audition for lessons through in Glasgow at the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama, because they had all the facilities, they had excellent equipment, and very, very good, very, very good teacher in Pamela Dow, who was the principal percussionist of the Royal Scottish Orchestra. And she was a hero of mine, because I would hear her play every week in the orchestra, and she's this very sort of powerful musician from the back of the orchestra, and really impressive and slightly daunting, but an amazing woman. And I really wanted to study with her. I was still very young. So we went to the music library and got out some exercise books for percussion. And I learned a little xylophone piece, a timpani piece, and a snare drum piece, and did this audition and got a place.
Age were you then, Colin?
I was 13 when I started with her. Mm. And that was huge. Big change, and also a firm coming down to earth, because I went in there with a lot of probably a lot of cheek and a lot of energy probably, but no clue with what to do with it really. So she was able to say, right, that's enough of that. We have to focus on this.
Now, you mentioned earlier how classical music, when you heard it first, was so powerful to you that everything else got sidelined. Mm. Was it Stravinsky?
Stravinsky, absolutely. One of my first memories of orchestral music was hearing the Firebird played by the Royal Scottish Orchestra. And the colour of it, and the sort of, I think the breadth of it, this was it was a ballet, so a lot happens. It was a sweeping story, quite romantic, and very, very beautiful. So gorgeous melodies, but also because it's Stravinsky, early Stravinsky, that's just that slight tinge of modernity. So everything that's slightly off kilter, slightly bizarre, challenging harmonies, exotic colors, just totally captivating. I mean, it pulls you right in, no way out. And that music has had me in its grip ever since.
Music there from Stravinsky, Infernal Dance from the Firebird. Nemi Järvi there with the London Symphony Orchestra. Colin Curry's with me in studio. Colin picked that one. You're very lucky as a young man, though, to hear that music, you know, because most people who hear classical music tend to discover that maybe through their own searches, as opposed to what's presented to them on radio or on television.
Yeah, I feel very lucky. Again, growing up in Edinburgh was seemed to be a good place for access to that kind of music, and that's given me a lot of pause for thought ever since. Is this how to get people over the line you know, if they want and if they feel good with that. So I'm always thinking about how is it that one can make opportunities for people to make these discoveries for themselves. I mean, these things are awkward to be forced on anyone, young or old, but there's such a wealth of amazing music out there that is still, I mean, even with someone like Stravinsky, I would say relatively untapped. Mm. I mean, he's not as... People, even like someone like Beethoven, he's underplayed in society. Beethoven should be everywhere. Mm. And yet it's still relatively on the fringe. And so I'm always... I mean, I don't know, really know the answer. I mean, I'm trying to do my bit, but I'm trying to bring people close to this classical canon of music that's just so important, so comforting, so haunting, so deep, so beautiful, so everything to me. I just would love to make it more widespread.
Now, we're probably jumping ahead musically here, and I'll not dwell on it just yet, but you are here doing your bit, as you say, for Great Music in Irish Houses Festival, which is on Saturday the 15th of June and at the Printworks, Dublin Castle. And now your programme for that includes Zanakis and Stockhausen and Steve Reich and people like that. And let's leave that to one side for a moment. I do want to talk about all that, which really interests me, actually, this kind of music. But when you were studying classical music and percussion initially, presumably you weren't thrown in with the Zanakis and the Steve Reich kind of music.
No, I was not. And so when I went to London to study, age 17 in the mid-90s, it was very much as an orchestral player. This was the path that was open to a young percussionist, would be to make orchestral training your focus and your goal, be to land a job in an orchestra. And of course, very laudable role. And I went through it and I played with orchestras. I freelanced in London for many years, and I love orchestras and I loved playing in orchestras, and I did all of that. But it was clear to me at that time that there was a lot of activity in the world of solo percussion and chamber music, especially. A lot of the key composers since the 60s, 50s and 60s, even 70s for sure, were featuring percussion in their music. And there were solo repertoire coming through of increasing quality as well as quantity. So that was very, very attractive to me, someone who loved new music.
But when you think of that sort of mainstream canon, I suppose it's a kind of a cliche that the percussionist stands at the back, you know, yeah, holding a triangle for one moment, for the big moment, yeah, or timpani in some particular pieces, yeah, you know, and I don't know, maybe a wood block or something.
Yeah.
And that would seem to me, I know that's not the case, but if that were the case, it would seem pretty dull compared to being in a bebop group with Max Roach and, you know, people like that. You know what I mean?
Well, there's a comparison for you. But I think the excitement for me was in the kind of music that percussion might feature in by composers such as Stockhausen and Zanakis, which you just mentioned there, and who I'll be playing in Dublin. And those composers really harnessed percussion very genuinely into their arsenal of artistic output.
Yeah, but what about, for instance, you've got the next one on your list here is Elgar.
Mm.
And in my head, without looking at it, without thinking about this seriously, in my head, I imagine there's not a whole lot for drummers to do in an Elgar, but obviously there is.
Well, the great thing about classical music is that in your own tastes, you can be as promiscuous and inclusive as you like. So when I approach Stockhausen, my love of Elgar is somehow in my mallets. I mean, that sounds very pretentious, and perhaps it
my
is.
My love of Elgar is somehow in my,
yeah,
in
but,
my mallets.
But the thing is, I believe that interest and knowledge and study of all these great composers is, first of all, a very satisfying thing. It's very enjoyable. It touches your soul. So although I don't play a note of Elgar, knowledge of his music and also getting to know his music at an early age and really connecting with it has been something that has shaped me as a musician. So when I get up there and attack Rebond B by Zanakis, somehow all of that training, it comes to bear.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I would have thought once you start listening to Zanakis and so on, Elgar's in the bin, you know?
No, it doesn't work like that. one does not discount the other. And I mean, I think some of the composers I've met, they maybe need to be more dogmatic and more binary. So if you're a modernist, you're a modernist. Mm. And some of those romantic composers may well just have no function for you at all. But I think I, as a performer, I'm used to meeting people who just have this broad church. And as I say, all of it ends up coming out in the way they make music.
Well, let's play a little bit of your Elgar choice. We can't play all of it because the first movement is about 20 minutes long.
Yes, indeed. But
what do you want to hear?
Well, I think I would love to hear some of that first movement because...
This is Symphony Number 1.
Symphony Number 1. It is an absolutely sort of devastating piece of music. It's highly emotional. It's very dignified. There's a sort of hold your head up high aspect to it. And I think Elgar has been very badly misunderstood and at worst misused. All the pomp and circumstance, the way that that's been... purloined by more vulgar forces is very upsetting for me. But if we can sort of reset the Elgar button, push that and listen to his first symphony and the purity of that music and the dignity it has and the seriousness of it and the genius of it. I mean, the Elgar First Symphony is a work of ravishing genius. It's incredibly beautiful, very, very powerful, very subtle, very imaginative. And just so broad, it's such a sweep of music. It's gorgeous.
Colin Curry with me in studio tonight. Colin, percussionist, who's going to be in Dublin with the Colin Curry Quartet, and we're going through some of the music that got him into his line of work, and that's music from Elgar, the opening movement, a part of it from Symphony Number 1. Daniel Barenboim there with Staatskapelle Berlin. We were talking just during that, about classical music and how it's presented, and there tends to be a kind of a canon of the greatest hits, and they get used a lot. And the reason I say this is your next choice is one of those pieces of music that will get played on this radio station so much that I've almost forgotten that it might be good, if you know what I mean. It's just overused in some way. And it's Respighi's The Pines of Rome.
Well, I'm delighted I picked a winner.
Yep.
but I think the great thing about this piece is that maybe we do forget the amazing achievement of this particular movement. And also, there's a genuine story for me, because I think one of the first times I played an orchestra, it was the Lothian Regional Orchestra, and I'd be 14 years old. And I got a last-minute place on the course. So I think one day I was in school, and the next day I was on a bus going to this orchestral course. I had no idea what was happening. And then that very evening, we started playing Pines of Rome. And so I was surrounded by the most bizarre and complex, actually, and fascinating music I think I'd probably ever heard. And this thing is based on nursery rhymes, but it's all incredibly high octane and kind of bizarro.
A friend of mine, a colleague in here, said it was a kind of pastiche involved in this as well. It was.
Yeah, I think pastiche is true, but it's a sort of na-na-na-na-na-na orchestral piece, and it's incredibly mischievous, but it's also, it's got that sort of Italian refined sort of Renaissance composers, thinking persons, work of really great genius. I mean, Respighi was quite a maverick and quite ahead of his time, and I'm actually delighted to have had that conversation with you in the break there, and find that it's become a sort of mainstream piece.
It's fair to say it's a staple on lyric, isn't it?
Uh huh.
You know, it's one of those ones I don't play.
Well, now you're going to play it.
I'm going to play it now.
Yeah.
And it's good for me to have this conversation too, because now I'll reassess my prejudice now because of what you just said. Because it is, well, you do get prejudiced against pieces of music, don't you?
I think, these pieces do circle around a lot. And as I play with orchestras, as I travel here and there, Yeah, you do hear this on orchestral programs quite a lot. I just heard the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra play it because in the second half of concerts I was giving with them in January this season. And so perhaps it's on my mind again because of that. But, you know, the audience reaction and the beauty of this music as well. I mean, this is the first movement, but there are four movements, and it goes on to have these incredibly powerful melodies that are so they're so attractive. They just pull you right in. And they've influenced so many different types of music, film music especially, perhaps. But this is the sort of original. We forget maybe also that this is where it first happened. These composers were so brilliant and masters of the orchestra. I think you can really hear that in this particular movement.
Colin Curry with me in studio tonight, picking the tunes. Music there from Respighi from the Pines of Rome, Charles Dutoit conducting the Orchestre Symphonique of Montreal. Now, tell me a little bit, Colin, about how you were taught to be a percussionist, if you know what I mean. It's one of those abilities that, I think people assume it's just natural. It's entirely natural that you've got this gift for complex rhythm and keeping a beat and all the rest of it. And I think people make that assumption because everybody can do it most people can do it a little. You tap your foot, you clap along with something. It seems kind of simple. So in what way are you taught to get to the sort of level that someone like yourself is at?
I will say this happily against myself. My timekeeping used to be not very good.
Really?
Yeah. And even in my...
Did you know that?
No, I wasn't particularly aware, but yeah. It was pointed out to me. I would often sort of rush ahead or be unstable. If I was buying the drum kit, I would throw things in that would sound weird or not fit the band. And so I think it's something that I did have to work on. But it is something that, like anything, like any craft... It's an enormous amount of work. So that's the rhythmic side of things. I think it is something that, I think initially there'll be varying degrees of talent. it can certainly be worked on. And I think awareness, rhythmic awareness, can be improved through your musical training and over the years. Numerous ways of doing that. And then the business of being taught to be a percussionist, well... You know, it might look pretty easy, but I can tell you, you know, especially in those early years, the lessons, I was slowed right down and I would do, I think, for 18 months, I was just doing simple strokes on the timpani. You might think timpani is just ba-ba-ba-bam,
yeah.
But playing the timpani, it's a very subtle stroke is needed, and the hand action, the wrist, and how everything works is a very finely honed technique. And so I went in thinking that I would just be learning complex etudes and smashing out all the orchestral excerpts. But the first 18 months of being a timpanist is just sitting in front of a mirror, just going boom, boom,
wow,
boom, boom, and just checking that your wrists look right and just gradually building up. And it was many months before I was even given any kind of green light to do a tremolando. So, you know, tremolando is way down the line.
It's a sentence you don't hear every day.
Not every day, but there it is.
And what about... working with, marimbas and that kind of thing, because that's a music. I was going to say it's a musical instrument, as if the drums aren't, but it's something you actually play melody on.
It's a keyboard instrument, so I understand your distinction. The marimba, so that was a sort of fledgling instrument. I mean, I played my first marimba concerto, aged 16, and at that point. It was a fairly new, fairly wacky instrument to have around. And I did get my own marimba around about that time, but it was it was great to get it. And it was very grateful to my family, you know, who stumped up to get it for me. But it was quite a basic instrument. The range of the instrument at that time was just 4 1/3 octaves. So it didn't go down below the low A on the bass clef. We had no idea where the marimba was going at that time. There was talk of a 5-octave instrument, but you know, no one had ever seen one in Scotland. It was still very early days for that kind of equipment.
And would that lead you away from the discipline of the classical world in a way? Because I'd imagine you start playing the marimba, things start to get jazzy and cool quite quickly.
Yeah, well, the marimba repertoire at that time was quite limited. I mean, but there were occasional pieces that would crop up that would be very interesting and would have sort of aspects of modernity to them that were very fruity and very attractive to me because they were very difficult. So it was a lot to get your sticks into and a lot to challenge you as a player. So I was always trying to find what was the next tricky piece around the corner. And so I was, you know, this is way before the internet, but I was scouring journals and having meetings with people, phone calls and things, trying to get hold of music. It was an interesting time, fledgling time for the instruments. But the development since then has been extraordinary, and you could never have seen it coming at that time.
So I guess because of the limited repertoire, and no repertoire at all in the older classical music for some of the instruments you were playing.
Yeah, none at all. Yeah,
you were being exposed early on to new music.
And yeah, that's it. And occasionally you would see these instruments featured by the great composers of the 20th century. So people like Olivier Messiaen, Pierre Boulez, Elliot Carter, they would use these instruments in their ensembles. You know, that was also another way into this music, and you could see the direction that maybe these instruments would be taking. Stockhausen famously wrote this piece, Contacto, which I play a lot. It's from 1960, and it's a very avant-garde work, very interesting. It remains a startling piece of the avant-garde, a beautiful piece, which I love to play. But a very difficult marimba part. Mm. And it remains one of the hardest things that I do play in my repertoire.
And the Beatles were listening to him, it's worth saying. Yeah. Now, those sorts of composers that we're talking about, what was your reaction to hearing those people for the first time? Because I asked that because you've already picked people like Elgar and Respighi, so you held on to that.
Yes.
Steve Reich, who you play with a lot, will say, I liked Paratone and Bach and all this kind of stuff. And then I just left out all the stuff in the middle and jumped right up ahead to Stravinsky. So he kind of, while admitting Beethoven is very good, he kind of dumped all that stuff. But you didn't.
Well, I think it's a more complex journey for a composer, as I think I've already alluded to in this chat.
Yeah, they've got a definite...
Yeah, I mean, you have to remember, for someone like Steve Reich, I mean, he was developing his language at a time when the kind of music he was writing was borderline banned by the powers that be. So post-Second World War, there was this enormous shake-up in the direction of so-called classical music, a crisis of classical music, which had already occurred with the crisis of tonality coming out of the music of Brahms and into Wagner, Schoenberg, Second Viennese School. Things were getting... Well, Richard Strauss... particularly early 20th century, you could hear things cracking and the crisis, the fin de siècle really came good there, and tonality was history really, but no one really knew the direction of music. But part of it was wrestled into a very dogmatic movement of post-Second World War composers led by people like Pierre Boulez and Stockhausen, whom I love, but who were very dogmatic.
Yeah.
Someone like Steve Reich was anathema to them. They had no truck with it whatsoever. And I know that Steve had to fight very hard to get recognition for his very hard-won by compositions. Being in the middle of it, I think he really had to stick to his guns, and he had to be... He couldn't really afford to be blasé or widespread with his tastes. He had to refocus and hone his art because he was writing it.
We spend a bit of time on Steve a little bit later on in the program, but one of the people you mentioned a moment ago, Elliot Carter, who passed away not all that long ago.
That's right,
he lived to a fair old age.
He did indeed.
And I think he lived somewhere around Jardin Square in New York. He lived somewhere around there.
Yes, he did, yeah.
Some of his music, well, all of his music is extraordinary, but if you haven't heard it before, it's kind of mind-blowing.
Yes, well, he was a remarkable figure. His lifespan, 1908 until 2012, is the sweep of modernity in music. So he was born at a time when the kind of techniques and the kind of music he wrote didn't exist. So he really lived it. He lived it, he developed it, he tussled with it. He went through the most, I mean, unimaginable creative process, and he was a genius. And I love his music very, very much indeed. Some of it is extremely difficult to listen to and is hard, even for me as a fan, to listen to. It poses me, I would even say, problems as a listener. It's difficult, it's dense, it's multi-layered. But much of his music is fortunately way more wide open, and so I'm a big sort of fan of his and proponent of his, because this music is profoundly beautiful. It's very melodic, it's highly inventive, it's mischievous, it's magical, and it's very, very interesting to consider his lifespan now and the amazing output that he's left us.
Okay, music from Elliot Carter. This is part of Variations for Orchestra. It's a terrible shame to fade that out, but that's Variations, part of Variations for Orchestra, from Elliot Carter, the choice of my guest tonight, Colin Curry, who's with me in studio. Colin, I notice now there's no Elliot Carter on your programme for the Printworks gig at Dublin Castle, which is on June the 15th, I should say again. But you've got Pereira, Zanaki, Stockhausen, Kevin Volans, and Steve Reich.
Yeah.
Now, these are people who... You know, if you haven't gone there before in your music listening, they would strike terror into the heart of some people, because they kind of heard of Stockhausen and they've been told it's scary stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And Steve Reich, oh, it's so repetitive, you know. And all these things are said about, you know. But and I was lucky enough to get, you know, hear Steve Reich, and changed how I listened to music when I did hear him. Is that still the case? And the reason I ask is, particularly Steve Reich, if you were brought up on electronica and dance music and all the rest of it, Steve Reich shouldn't be as difficult as it was when it first appeared.
Or even if you were brought up on Bach.
Well, true.
Because I think Brandenburg is never far away with someone like Steve Reich. Yeah, I mean, a big challenge, I think, for anyone playing new music is how to just crush this myth that surrounds it, that it is somehow difficult or not approachable. Or the fact that even if it is difficult, that would be a bad thing.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, that's a good point.
What is the audience that would shy away from a film that's challenging or unsettling, or a museum? You know, these modern art galleries that are just filled to the rafters.
If you're prepared to sit down and watch The Wire,
yeah,
or something like that, you know, that's demanding as well.
Yeah, and so I think, sadly, very sadly, tragically, perhaps, unless we sort of fight harder, which I'm trying to do. The brush that's tarnished some of these composers, this word modern or avant-garde is seen as something that's not approachable. It's just one cannot go there. I mean, how am I ever going to get to grips with this music? But I think it's also important to know that this kind of music is abstract, and it's perhaps not there to be understood. Mm-hmm. I don't understand it. Yeah. I tell you now. Freely admit, I don't understand these pieces, but I do have a strong instinct for them, and they appeal to me, and somehow I know how they should go. And of course, that is partly due to background, education, and but more than anything, it's to do with a love of this music, which just comes from within. So these pieces, especially the ones we're presenting in Dublin, we just played a concert in Norwich, Norfolk and Norwich Festival. We sold out the Playhouse. And people were, you know, whooping and cheering at the Stockhausen, at the Pereira, everything. And It's partly how it's done. I mean, as a percussionist as well, I think we've kind of got a loaded deck of cards because the appeal of the instruments, I think, is so high. So I think new music on percussion is something that is incredibly strong and very, very appealing to a crowd. And we love sharing it.
Now, I'd like to play one of the pieces that you're going to perform, which is the Steve Reich piece, Drumming.
Sure.
Funny, I listened to it quite recently. It on the face of it, it's probably the toughest of the Steve Reich pieces because it is drumming. That's all it is, you know. And yet, I mean, it's not, and it becomes this incredibly strange thing where you can almost see the music moving around.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about, and this is the big challenge, obviously, for percussionist Steve Reich and his whole idea of phasing and the way that comes in. It maybe even demonstrated with the clapping idea, but that drumming where there's a drum and then another drum and then that phase. Try and explain.
Oh,
that.
Sure, absolutely. Well, what we're going to play at our concert, and it's the crowning moment of the program, it's the final item, is part one of a large scale work by Steve Reich called Drumming. And what it thrives on is just maximum impact from a minimal amount of material. So the first thing you hear is the theme, which is built up one note at a time. So the piece begins just with one note. Bum, bum, repeated. Bum, bum, like this. Bum. And you hear it over and over again. And then eventually, bum, 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 two notes. And then da-dum-dum, 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 three notes. Eventually, the whole pattern is built up. And that lovely, bouncy, swingy rhythm, melody almost, because it's played on tuned drums of G-sharp, A-sharp, B-natural, and C-sharp, just bounces along. But what it is subjected to is a highly intoxicating set of variations in which the musicians face off against each other, literally standing opposite me as a fellow musician. And I will keep that pattern very, very steady whilst my colleague accelerates very, very slowly away from me, mm-hmm. maintaining their pattern, but just pushing ahead very, very slightly away from me, taking the pattern, the rhythm, into this berserko twilight zone in which we're no longer playing together. So you're kind of, and eventually it settles down into a new place in which that musician is at a preordained new point in the rhythm, rejoining me but making a new counterpoint. So they're playing the same rhythm as they were before, but they've accelerated ahead of me. So they're playing with me once again, but a new point in the music.
I've had the honor, and it's always a pleasure to talk to Steve Reich many times, public interviews and on the radio and one thing and another. And I've asked him these questions, but it's great to talk to someone who actually has to perform this stuff.
Yeah,
because there seems to be a huge amount of is it mathematics? And even apart from that, the sheer stamina and concentration that must be involved.
Well, it's very hard to pick a favourite, but for me, drumming really does have something extraordinary.
Drumming, or part of it, from Steve Reich and Colin Curry and the Quartet will be performing Drumming Part 1 as part of the Great Music in Irish Houses Festival 2019, 15th of June. That's a Saturday night at 9 p.m. at the Printworks in Dublin, along with music from Pereira, Zanakis, Stockhausen and Kevin Volans. We'll be right back after this. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. We're here until 9 o'clock. For the past hour, I've been talking to Colin Curry. Colin, we were talking a lot about Steve Reich there, and how other composers like Pierre Boulez were very They thought he was an idiot, actually, at times, you know. But that Steve Reich and others like him really did have to break through serious opposition, because Boulez and the rest of them were in control of what was new and what was acceptable.
Well, it can't have been easy for him. And I'm very grateful to him, along with so many other listeners and fans of not only his music, but equally valid, or certainly you could even say more widespread development in music that happened. And so what really happened in the end, I suppose you could say, is that Boulez has in fact become slightly more on the fringe. Mm. He's more of a fringe figure than Steve Reich, that's for sure. It's not a competition, though. But without Steve Reich, you know, who knows? That whole movement of music might have been lost. Mm. So I think, first of all, it's this deep gratitude that Reich persevered through what must have been very difficult times, as he was trying to throw the window wide open so we could get that fresh air and blue sky once again in the music.
Yeah. Now, what's it like working with Steve? You're his go-to guy now as percussionist, and you've recorded with him. And the last time I spoke to Steve, he was talking about you. And he's very exacting. I mean, he's got his own way of doing what his own music. He's got his own way of doing it, and there's no other way.
Yeah, this is what I like about him perhaps the most. He is fully charged, and he's precise, and he's demanding. But the main thing that we take away from it as a group is the clarity of vision that he has for his music. And that's something that's totally invaluable, of course. So all the many, many pieces that he's been present for us performing, he's given comments on tempos, on approach, dynamic, subtleties, and all kinds of insight that we are able to absorb. And we're carrying it on. We take it very, very, very seriously. It sounds maybe a little highfalutin, but we see ourselves, we hope that we will be ambassadors for this music moving forward. Mm. And maintain a tradition of how perhaps his music can be played. That said, I mean, my group does play his music quite differently to other ensembles. We're a little wider on the dynamic range, a little stronger on some of the hits we give, and a little more heart on the sleeve. So, for example, we recently played a piece of his called Pulse, which can be done kind of flat and very sort of, and it works very, very beautifully. It can be very, very streamlined and just kind of let it happen. But we kind of, first of all, we slowed it down a bit. We don't play it as fast as it was originally played. And we've warmed it up quite a lot. So there's a little more vibrato used, a little more sensitivity. And fortunately, Steve really reacted very, very strongly to that and loved our performance of it.
Maybe we should just play a little bit of it, yeah?
Please do, yeah.
This is from your own release, Colin Curry and Steve Reich. And of course, he was there and he was part of this.
Exactly.
And now I've seen him in action. Was there any negotiating to be done about this, or was he? He was
well. No, he. He was at these rehearsals. He came and heard us. What was slightly nerve wracking was the very first time I performed for him. He did not attend any soundcheck. He just came to the concert 2011 at the South Bank, and I was incredibly nervous because I knew full well the way we played his music was quite different to what he might have heard before. Mercifully, he was bowled over by our performance, and certainly for the most part, he's been absolutely thrilled with everything we've done ever since. You know, occasionally he's steered us in a slightly different direction, pulled us back from one or two ideas, but always very positive, always very helpful. And he's a great colleague and really friendly with the group. Great banter.
What's he doing here
on this recording? Yeah. Well, this was a fantastic set of incredible set of concerts that was set up by the Fondation Louis Vuitton in Paris. It was basically a kind of exhibition for Steve. They had manuscripts in the galleries. They had talks about his music, and furthermore, very much so, concerts. And these were curated by myself and Steve. He appointed my group, the Resident Ensemble, and we were able to make an album from it. So we made this Live in Paris album that we now just released, and contains some marvelous works, and including this just treasure, this gem of a new piece, Pulse, which is just gorgeous.
Well, I'm already getting lost and drifting off listening to that. It's extraordinary stuff. Pulse Live, Colin Curry Group from the album Colin Curry and Steve Reich, live at Fondation Louis Vuitton. If you're going to do a live show, that sounds like a place to do it.
It's right? An incredible place. Yeah, it's like a spaceship.
Sounds good. As I say, on your concert, you'll be performing music from Steve Reich. You'll be performing drumming. We could end up talking about Steve all night, but one of the reasons is, I guess, if you've encountered him, he's very influential on your musical taste and development and listening behaviours. And I noticed the next musician on your, or the next musical choice you have is Bartók.
Mm.
And he's another one that Steve references as, you know, I'll stop at Bach and I'll jump right ahead to Stravinsky and Bartók, you know, that's the stuff. And I also know that a lot of jazz musicians that Steve loved, like Max Roach and people like that, they all listened to Bartók.
Yeah.
What is it about, now, there are lots of different types of Bartók music, but you're going to play music from the string quartets, which are amazing. What is it about Bartók's music, do you think, that appeals to people who like, say, jazz or a bit edgier or a bit more into the what later would become avant-garde music?
Well, you're spot on about Steve. He often talks about the three Bs in his influence, which is Bach, Bartók, and bebop. Mm. And they've all got things in common, all very, very appealing. Bartók's music is extremely rigorous, very, very strong, very melodic, of course, because he sourced a lot of his material from the folk music of where he, from the area of where he lived, where he grew up, not just Hungary, but parts of Romania as well. And he would do extraordinary things with his folk melodies. He would spice them up, pepper them up.
As opposed to sweeten them up.
He would give them a real boost in terms of how sort of edgy they could maybe be. But the thing that I love most about Bartók's music is that it has incredible soul. I'm a huge fan of Stravinsky and Bartók in totally different ways, because Stravinsky is less soulful, I would say, overall, though the music is utterly miraculous. But Bartók is this big-hearted, just emotionally devastating composer. And the six quartets are very, very famous for this, because it's an incredible sweep. The journey from quartet one to quartet six is an incredible musical experience. But when you hear a good quartet playing these pieces live, they're utterly thrilling. I mean, they're incredibly energetic and kind of wild.
Music from Béla Bartók, the choice of Colin Curry, who's with me tonight. That was the final movement of the string quartet number 4, the Emerson Quartet performing that. Now, we've been talking largely about the classical music you listened to growing up, and then the new music and all this exciting kind of out there music that you perform now with your group. But the pop music side, even though it was sidelined by this kind of music, and you walked in today wearing a Talking Heads top. And, you know, if you're around people like Steve Reich as well, you know that that world circled him too. And, you know, people like Bowie went to all his shows and, you know, I remember having a conversation with Steve Reich about Joey Ramone once. So, I mean, it's a New York scene and there's a lot of interplay and interconnection and people show up for each other's events. And Talking Heads is on your list.
Oh, yeah.
And I know that for you it's real. I mean, sometimes I talk to classical musicians and their knowledge of popular music is so narrow, it's kind of astonishing to me that how can you get through life and not know these other types of music, you know, because it's on the radio, it's around you.
Yeah.
And sometimes they say, oh, well, I quite like Simply Red, or, you know, they throw in some name, you know, and you know it's not real. But I can tell from some of the names on your list here that this music means something to you.
Yeah, well, my relationship with pop music... I already sound pretentious, don't I? My relationship with pop music. The thing is, I have blown hot and cold with pop. And I think the thing is, like anyone, is eventually you do find something that just totally clicks and something that's very, very personal. And my taste in pop, I think, comes from these extraordinary individuals that do occasionally, and not often, I would contest, surface in pop culture and are able to take their genius into the mainstream. And a band like Talking Heads, I think that happens so seldom, because the way they gelled and the tunes they wrote and the songs that they had and their live show, of course, incredibly famous live show, which they would made into a film, famous film, and the artistry that they brought to everything they did was just incredible. And it took me a while to discover them fully, but when I did, I just couldn't stop listening to them. And especially the tune that we've picked out, This Must Be the Place, which is perhaps their most famous melody. It's been used all over the place and in films and different times, different locations. And it means different things to different people, but I just love it on so many levels. There could even be this Steve Reichian level, because whole thing is an ostinato. It never goes away. The bass line never changes. And it's always the same background to whatever's happening.
And also to my ear, too, a bit like Steve Reich. It's New York music, you know?
Yeah.
And that's Talking Heads, and This Must Be the Place. When you start, you know, you talked about when you heard classical music, you sidelined pop. At any point in your classical and new music career, did you listen to pop music again and think, you know, I'd rather be doing that, it'd be more fun?
Well, I had an interesting experience a few years ago. At almost no notice at all, I was asked to play drums for Todd Rundgren.
Right, yeah. out of the blue.
And this happened by accident, and it was a festival in Holland, and he was playing with a string quartet in this sort of slightly bizarre setup that he was doing at the time, and they felt they were missing a drummer, but I was floating around the festival, so I was asked if I would do it. And you know, I'm not a drummer, but I can...
What do you mean you're not a drummer?
Well, because I would never call myself a drummer, because a true drummer who can really play the drums really, really well, that's a whole skill set and set of experiences that I've never got into properly. I mean, I can sit behind the drum kit, I can play, but you could tell it's not a rock and roller sitting there doing it. But I was given this amazing opportunity to play with Mr. Rundgren. And first of all, he was really, really nice. He was a lovely guy. And I thought his music was fantastic. And he was a brilliant singer, performer, guitarist. And then the next day, after having played with him, I would go on and research his music a bit more, and I found out exactly who he was, and I was kind of galled by what I'd just done. So we had this sound check in which I couldn't really hear the band very well, and it was a little bit awkward, and I kind of played okay, but it came to the gig, I just thought, right, here we go, I'm going to have to just let this go. So I just absolutely wailed on the drums, and it kind of worked out, and it was funny, because at the end of the gig, I went to speak to him, and he said to me, "Yeah, man, you played real good. I never heard a drummer learn to play the drums so quickly." So it was kind of funny, because he was able to sting me with this thing like, well, yeah, I could tell it wasn't really your jam, but at the same time, you got it together, and I want to thank you for that.
Now, Pierre Boulez features again in your next choice, but this time it's himself. It's his own music.
Yeah.
Given what you know about Boulez, you're still open to his music, even though we shut out so much other stuff.
Very, very much. I mean, I hope that you will permit me to be so promiscuous as in my tastes. We've just come from Talking Heads to Pierre Boulez, Notation. Right. But these are all things that have made me think, for sure. And Boulez, I'm a fan of. I was lucky enough to... hear many of his concerts live. London Symphony Orchestra would frequently present anniversary series. So I was present at his 70th, 75th seasons, 80th. He all had these incredible concert series in London. And hearing him play a lot of this music that we've already heard Debussy, Bartok. It was all revelatory, but it was never, ever more interesting than when he did his own music, because the way he conducted and the way he brought the music to life, it was just so quintessentially him. I mean, I think that he wrote his music in a way that he was able to conduct it, so it was so beautiful to watch. It was so instinctive, it was so natural. And although there was great complexity to it, to witness him pull it off live, he made a great logic of it, and it was incredibly beautiful to be close to.
Now, we're going to play music from Notation.
Yeah.
Might need an edit here on you, because I'm just trying to figure out. It's down here as Notation pour piano, but on your list you've got a particular movement.
Yes, it's the Notation were piano pieces, and he took to orchestrating them, and he orchestrated several of them. Initially, he orchestrated four of them, but he went on to orchestrate, I think, at least one more. And I heard him conduct these pieces live, and the one we're going to hear is an absolutely fantastic tour de force for the orchestra. It's kind of anarchic, but yet it has an incredible groove. I mean, that's the word to use. It's got this absolute smashing just beat through the whole orchestra. It's propelled by this great excitement from the rhythmic precision from the percussionists. But it's a vast orchestra, and it's a real cacophonous piece, but it's incredibly exciting. It's very, very intense and just that little bit scary.
Notation, number 7, the Seattle Symphony there, music from Pierre Boulez. You have chosen a piece from a Steve Reich album. What's your favorite? I mean, Music for 18 is the big one, I guess. But is this your favorite to him in?
There is a sort of holy grail of pieces to get to as a Steve Reich performer. Music for 18 is definitely part of that, as is drumming. But one I always wanted to get to was Tehillim, which is easily his most melodic work. Now, he's not known for his melodies, Steve. His music is more renowned for other items, musically speaking. But he just wrote the most gorgeous work in Tehillim. It's in four movements, and it's based on Hebrew texts, psalm settings. And very, very powerful word setting indeed. It's a very uplifting piece of music. It's very, very moving and incredibly melodic. I mean, once you get these melodies in your head, you will be singing them for the rest of your days. I mean, they're just so, so thrillingly compelling and so touching. And again, I think the word setting and also the spiritual aspect of this piece is incredibly uplifting and very, very moving, which is not how you would normally perhaps expect to react to a Steve Reich piece. But when we did this work, the first time we ever did it, we did it in Tokyo. And it was an otherworldly experience. And everyone in the group was just blown away by putting this music together for the first time. It was an extraordinary experience.
Tehillim from Steve Reich. Part of Tehillim from Steve Reich, the Schoenberg Ensemble with percussion group The Hague, Reinbert Deleu. Conducting music from Steve Reich. The choice of Colin Curry. If you like Steve Reich, Colin will be performing Drumming Part 1 by Steve Reich at Great Music in Irish Houses at the Printworks Dublin Castle, Saturday 15th of June, 9 p.m. Also music from Kevin Volans, Stockhausen, Zanakis and Pereira. Your next choice is Joy Division. Mm. And maybe this might touch on what we happened to be talking about during that record. Sometimes you get music, like Steve Reich and Kraftwerk and others, where the potential for it to be funky and groovy and make you want to dance and move seems limited, and yet it's there.
Oh, yeah.
It's still there.
Yeah.
How does that work? Because, you know, you put on James Brown or you put on, you know, Parliament or Prince or something like that. Mm. Yes, you will dance.
Yeah.
But sometimes you hear music where that aspect seems to have been stripped away, and yet it remains danceable and funky and all those things.
I think it's timing is everything. And sometimes I think something emerges by accident almost, and I think that's very definitely the case with Joy Division. I mean, they're just the most fascinating group of these incredibly, I mean, this is the thing you forget, I forget it all the time, young men
very
in their
young.
Early 20s mm-hmm. producing music of devastating profundity and also complexity, which I think that they were perhaps not aware of at the time, because I know from a little bit of that I know about them and the things I've read and watched online is that they also, where they rehearsed, they couldn't really hear each other very, very well. And also, the other musicians in the group didn't always know, by any means, what poor Ian Curtis was singing about mm-hmm. and the sort of devastating place that he found himself in as someone who was dealing with incredibly profound and tragic problems. So the Joy Division thing is a sort of force of nature, and I'm very, very interested by that in music. I mean, I don't know what their training was as musicians, but it cannot have been particularly profound in the sense of coming through a classical education. I doubt they read music particularly well, or I'm not certain, but I think what they were able to create just from nothing, it is just simply extraordinary. And that's broadly the appeal that I feel for this music, which I find is just as deep as anything and very harrowing and very, very beautiful all at the same time. The drumming itself is also very, very different. The drummer is given a sort of elevated role in that group, mm-hmm. A bit more creative than you might expect, I would have to say, your typical pop track. But Joy Division is no typical pop band, and that's the thing about them is that it's just this extraordinary ferment, a very, very kind of vital and frenzied creativity.
Okay, Disorder, Joy Division. Disorder from Joy Division, the second last choice tonight from Colin Curry. Colin is a very, very well-renowned percussionist, and with his group, the Colin Curry Quartet, he'll be performing on Saturday the 15th of June at the Printworks in Dublin Castle as part of the Great Music in Irish Houses Festival. And I know I've said this already, but if you're into either this kind of music or you want to have your mind blown by this kind of music for the first time, I highly recommend you go to hear them perform music by Pereira, Zanakis, Stockhausen, Volans, and Steve Reich. That's going to involve on stage, between all of that, you know, marimbas, drums, what else have we got up there?
Vibraphones. Yeah. We've got multiple percussion instruments. And actually, just a quick word about this really brilliant new work we're bringing by Kevin Volans, which is a work for four marimbas. So we're going to form a square with that piece and kind of face each other. And this work is absolutely amazing. We just gave the European premiere in Norwich, and it's a beautiful, beautiful piece that really unleashes the unique sort of burgundy brilliance of the marimba. I don't want to spoil it by saying too much about it, but it's truly worth hearing. Really.
The burgundy brilliance of the marimba.
Yeah. That sound, you know, because it's made of, the marimba is the wooden keyboard instrument, but it's got that sort of rich quality to it. And this piece is a cheeky little number. It's very, very quick. The whole piece, it's quite a long piece, 20-minute piece. Very up tempo, the whole thing. It's never very loud, but it's very busy. It's I've never seen so many notes on a page, but it's a beautiful piece, and the composer will be there. So, looking forward to that one a lot.
Oh, that's great. Well, again, that's Saturday, 15th of June, at the Printworks in Dublin Castle. Colin, thank you so much for coming in tonight.
Yeah, pleasure. It's been
really,
nice.
Really enjoyed talking to you, and I think you might have opened a few minds as well.
Hope so. Yeah.
Colin, thanks for coming in. Great choices, great music, and really appreciate it. Your last one is Steely Dan.
Yeah.
They knew how to put together music.
Yeah, well, Steely Dan, again, this is something that I had my toe dipped into for a while now, but it's a more recent obsession. And just getting to know their albums and their musical journey, I mean, it's just so attractive, so lovely. Their songs are so quirky, and they remind me of so many things. I mean, they're sort of a little bit, even I would say, of the bizarreness of Frank Zappa, mm-hmm. Social commentary of Bob Dylan a little bit. Mm-hmm. But they're kind of jazzers, but they're not really. They're rockers, but they're a bit too funky for that. So they're impossible to pin down. But what they did do was they worked with the most amazing musicians of their time, and they would constantly have people in and out the door. So, for example, on the album Asia, it was at least three different drummers. Goodness knows how many guitarists. And actually, the song we're going to look at, Peg, famously, they kept on bringing in guitarists to attempt a solo in the middle of this song. And whilst it was always good that they were only working with the best people, it would never quite hit the spot. So I think it was the seventh or eighth guitarist who attempted the solo was the one that they took. And it's this kind of famous, very strange guitar solo that is really lovable and kind of odd, like their whole music. Don Fagan's vocals, his voice is so strange, but, you know, deeply, deeply, deeply a lovable sound and voice. It's a great band.
Colin, thanks a million.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.